DW Africa Link.
Côte d'Ivoire's president Alassane Ouattara is back for a fourth term. He won by a landslide with nearly 90% of the votes cast. But with top rivals blocked from the race and turnout at just 50%, critics say democracy took a backseat. So has Ouattara strengthened the nation's future or deepened its divisions? And what does his continuity mean for the country and the region as a whole? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
In a nation of 30 million, nearly 9 million Ivorians were registered to vote, but only half turned up, and the majority by far voted to continue with the incumbent Alassane Ouattara. Now, it is worth noting that the exclusion of opposition leaders like former President Laurent Gbagbo and Tijani Thiam overshadowed the election. So what's really at stake for Ivorians? Ouattara pitches his nearly 15-year legacy of economic stability and growth, but critics warn that a fourth term would tighten control and leave democracy in doubt. With opposition fractured, some fear voter apathy and question how deeply the vote reflects people's desires. All right, let's discuss further with DW's correspondent on the ground, Bram Postumus, and Dr. Alex Vines, Africa Director, European Council on Foreign Relations. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome to Africa Link. Bram, you saw and heard for yourself the reactions after Alassane Ouattara was declared the winner. Can you share with us?
Oh, absolutely. The reactions were, as you could expect, a bit divided, in the sense that, yeah, the overwhelming majority obviously voted in the incumbent Alassane Ouattara, who will now continue for another 5 years. But then look at the turnout. The turnout is probably, we're not entirely sure yet because we haven't got the final figures, but the turnout is at an historic low, below 50%. So as you walked around Abidjan, as I did, and talked to people, there was, on the one hand, a kind of resignation in the sense that, yeah, we know he's going to win, so therefore we may not even bother and go out and vote, which obviously a lot of people have made that decision. And on the other hand, there was also support for the fact that, look, we have a president in place who has been working for the 15 years he's been in power. And look at the infrastructure, look at the electricity, which is now almost full coverage across the country, and all the other good things. We've got peace, we've got a certain amount of stability. Let him carry on. So, you know, that's... And then obviously there is a very vocal opposition which challenges the constitutionality of his fourth term, thinks he is illegal, and they challenge the entire electoral procedure, which they think was outside the law.
Do you get the overall sense, Bram, that overall he seems to be an accepted leader?
Accepted is probably too big a word to use. Don't forget also that the ruling party, which he represents, has an enormous, colossal machine, literally a machine in place to win this election, which included transport, logistics. He flew around in private jets and helicopters. So,
is there a general sense that people get that the election was free and fair, and that the leader majority voted for is the one leading them now?
Well, that obviously depends on who you talk to. The two major opposition parties, the former ruling PDCI and the PPRC of former President Laurent Gbagbo, both had no candidates fielded. So you could also argue, for all kinds of complex reasons, that this election was actually not free and fair because the major candidates could not participate. That's an argument that you will hear from the opposition side. And then from the Ouattara side, people will say, listen, let him carry on because he's doing a good job. So again, there is division, but it's difficult to gauge exactly, you know, where people's opinions are. And this has got to do with another issue that's come up during this election, and that is the machinery of repression, which was very evident and was obviously designed to intimidate. And I think people are very wary of actually expressing their opinions. It's an Ivorian thing, really, but it's also very real.
Right. And can you highlight a bit more the reports of violence or intimidation and how security forces reacted to it after the results were announced?
Yes, well, there has been during and after the elections, there has been heavy patrolling all around the country, not just in Abidjan, but everywhere. So that's obviously one feature of it. There have been a few skirmishes, especially in the west of the country, around the city of Daloa, which is the major city in the west of the country, which was a little bit expected because there were issues around permission or not to work on the lands, which we will not go into now because that's extremely complex. But it was expected that there would be some areas where skirmishes would occur because unscrupulous politicians make use of already existing differences, local differences. It hasn't been on the scale of 2020 when 85 people died, let alone on the scale of 2010, 2011, when this descended into full-scale civil war. And obviously, the force that was 44,000 strong, soldiers, gendarmes, and the police, was designed to make sure that none of this really serious violence happened. And it was also designed to intimidate. And it seems that they have, by and large, succeeded in doing exactly that.
Thanks, Bram. Alex, with this result, what does Cote d'Ivoire's political future look like? Are we talking steadier or fragile under the surface? How would you describe it?
Yeah, the markets and investors are all, they'd already baked in a landslide victory for Ouattara for all the reasons that Bram has outlined. And so investors really do see Cote d'Ivoire as a hot ticket, again, for the reasons that have just been discussed, the electrification, the infrastructure, the human capital that is in Cote d'Ivoire. Ivorians are better educated, able to do a variety of different commercial tasks. Then the insecurity around Cote d'Ivoire is also attracting a retreat of investments into Cote d'Ivoire. So the problems of the Sahel, and particularly the mining industries up there for international investors, including gold, means that there's quite a bit of new investment coming into Cote d'Ivoire for exploration. So the fourth term of Ouattara is likely to see more investment and kind of more development in the country. The problem lies in that Mr. Ouattara is aging. He's 83. This is his fourth term. After 5 years, what next? Will he try and knock out again opposition and create a pathway for a fifth term? That would be destabilizing for Cote d'Ivoire. So political succession, I think, is going to be very much a poignant issue now during the next term. You know, who are the people that will stand up and contest election and try and succeed Mr. Ouattara?
Right. But what should we make of the fact that voter turnout was at record low numbers?
I think that Ivorians in the south were resigned that the two kind of prime candidates, Mr. Thiam and the former president, Laurent Gbagbo, were knocked out for different reasons. Thiam because of his French nationality, Gbagbo because he had been indicted for his involvement in the Ivorian conflict. And so you have low turnout in Abidjan and in the south, but you did have high turnout in the north, the heartlands of Ouattara. And so you have regional divides also. That in itself raises some issues about inequality, but also kind of the regionalism of Cote d'Ivoire, which is something that I think Ivorian politicians and President Ouattara needs to keep an eye on. The reality is that Mr. Ouattara is pretty unpopular in Abidjan, which is why when Bram was walking around on election day and talking to people, there was a fatalism there. If he'd gone further north to Bouaké and various places further north, I think the atmosphere might have been rather different.
Knowing Bram, he was definitely walking around, very busy, speaking to people and getting their reactions, some of which you've already shared with us, Bram. Is there a sense of relief?
Relief in the sense that people were quite happy that it was finally done and dusted. One of the overwhelming sentiments that you got definitely from Abidjan was indeed that people said, well, let's just get this circus over and done with, and then we can get on with what we're supposed to be doing, which is work and make a living and earn money. And so in that sense, it was seen more as disruptive than anything else. I think Alex's point about regionalism is quite important here as well, especially when you look at the points of turnout. The campaign, President Ouattara started his campaign in the city of Daloa in the west. That was very, very deliberate. The west was former President Gbagbo's fief, if you like. I mean, he was always very popular there. He's lost a lot of that popularity. And he wanted to make a point. He wanted to make the point that, all right, I'm not just the president of the north, which is what he is widely seen as. I'm also the president of other parts of the country. So he made that point very strongly to start his campaign in Daloa. And don't forget also that just before the campaigns began, he raised the price of cocoa, farm gate price of cocoa, to an unprecedented 2,800 francs per kilo. That was to placate the center, the heartland, and the west, where the cocoa is grown. So again, indeed, regionalism is a very important aspect of these elections, and it's something that needs to be dealt with in more than a sort of mercantile fashion, as seems to be the hallmark of this particular government.
Right. Thanks, Bram. We were talking about the regional importance of all of this, right? I'm going to come to you, Alex, because Ouattara's pro-Western stance, especially toward France and the EU in general, it seems to have strained relations with junta-led neighbors like Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. Is that an actual challenge, you think, for his fourth term? Or what do you make of that?
So that's a good question. There was neighboring Burkina Faso was certainly the junta there was trying to influence the politics in Cote d'Ivoire, certainly in the far north, but also through disinformation campaigns. And there are good examples of kind of fake news and half news and disinformation. I don't think, I'd be interested to hear what Bram thinks, that it had much of an impact on the election at all. But there's plenty of evidence of it. Indeed, my own organization, the European Council on Foreign Relations, issued a report last week called The Bear and the Bot Farm, which was looking at kind of Russian training and contribution to disinformation across West Africa. And we do see a pattern of real spiking around elections. It happened in Ghana. It happened in Senegal. It happened in Nigeria. And now it's been occurring in Cote d'Ivoire. But the Ivorian story is a bit different from some of the others in that it didn't really penetrate through. In fact, that's the story of Ghana, too. The pattern is pretty similar. But it shows you the intent. And it also tells you something that President Ouattara and his pro kind of Western slant, he is not as aggressively allergic to the French, for example, is something that doesn't settle well with some of his neighbors, such as the junta in Burkina Faso and Ouagadougou. And so we will have to see how the Ouattara's administration handles this. In Ghana, with a change of government there, there is now a different strategy under the Mahama administration on dealing with the AES countries, and particularly Burkina, than there was under the Nana Akufo-Addo administration, for example. Whether Ouattara will change strategy, we'll have to see.
I am pretty sure, Bram, you want to weigh in on this.
Well, these are very, very important points for a number of reasons. You know, yes, indeed, there have been attempts by the junta, especially the one of Captain Ibrahim Traoré in Burkina Faso, to influence the elections. Indeed, the impact has been limited. It's partly because there has been so much hostility coming out of Burkina Faso towards Cote d'Ivoire, and specifically its government and the president, that Ivorians tend to be a little bit leery of anything coming from across the border. So they tend to take that with a grain of salt, actually, rather than just, taking it in as the gospel truth. So in that sense, I think the attempts have absolutely been there. There have also been counter-attempts from the Ivorian intelligence services to make sure that this didn't go through on a wider scale. And I think by and large, that's been rather successful. But there's two other things that you need to add to this. The first is that there is a huge community of Malians, Burkinabe, and Nigerians who live in this country, who work in this country, who send money home. There's millions of them. And they obviously don't want to rock the boat too much for the simple reason that then they've got nothing to send home. And their families survive on what is being sent across through Orange Money or any of the other mobile money services, because that's the source. Here is the source. This is where the economy is. There is hardly an economy of any worth in the AES countries. And so they rely on money from Abidjan and elsewhere in Bouaké to survive. So that's one. And the other thing is, there is obviously a great concern about the stability of the at least two of the three junta-led Sahel countries, most notably Mali, which is currently under a blockade by the Islamic jihadists, and Burkina Faso, which is to all intents and purposes collapsing because of the same kind of jihadist influences. And it's very, very difficult to predict how these countries are going to behave in the event of any of these juntas either falling or collapsing on itself, or a violent regime change. And this is obviously a great worry on this side of the border, because we have absolutely no idea what to expect.
Right. Alex, let's pick up from where Bram left off, because indeed, Cote d'Ivoire is seen by many as a strategic partner in West Africa's fight against extremism, right? Particularly in the Sahel region. With Ouattara remaining president, is there anything at stake? How influential can Cote d'Ivoire be in this fight?
Well, Western focus is about resilience of coastal states at the moment, for the reasons that Bram has outlined. There is tremendous anxiety about the ability of the junta in Burkina Faso or the one in Mali necessarily to survive. And there are discussions in Abidjan, but also in Accra, in Abuja. What do you do if suddenly you have a complete buckling and you have a jihadist aligned administration suddenly prevailing? How do you handle that? Or do you actually try and prop up juntas as a kind of least worst option? So these are the sorts of conversations that are happening. Now, global capital wants to protect the coast, and this is where you see kind of investments coming in. Mining industry is hot at the moment for strategic and critical minerals, but also for gold, given the prices. And so you have increasing focus on the Ghanas and Cote d'Ivoires of the world in terms of partnerships for security, but also for investment.
Let's now get back into the country, Cote d'Ivoire, right? What are the biggest priorities Ouattara must tackle right now if he wants to avoid unrest? There are many issues that need tackling, aren't there, Alex?
Yes. So despite economic growth, the GDP figures, the infrastructure, the electrification, those are all good. So Cote d'Ivoire has done good things, I would argue, in that respect over the 15 years that Ouattara has been president. But inequality has really grown in the country. And so you have growing pools of young people that are unemployed or underemployed, and you have a smaller group of people getting a lot richer. And that is going to just fuel frustration and discontent. And so dealing with inequality and actually focusing on job creation, I think, is a priority for the fourth term of the Ouattara administration.
No doubt, Bram, that especially youth unemployment should be high on the agenda, right? Considering how youthful a population Côte d'Ivoire is.
Absolutely. The number one issue, when you talk to people about what the most important issue in their lives is, they will talk to you about the cost of living. Things are just too expensive. And this feeds in immediately into this whole issue of inequality, because the party in power and those who are in government is people by individuals who do not really feel the pinch of the cost of living because they're doing fine, thank you very much. That's the root of the inequality. Inequality is fueled by, you know, government policy, which is unfettered free markets, neoliberalist, you know, in outlook. Remember, Ouattara is a technocrat who came from the International Monetary Fund. He's never, denounced, if you like, the Washington consensus, which holds that the state must pull back and must let the free market decide. And so if you have this kind of policy, then you don't really have, apart from a bit of lip service, you don't really have a social policy. How do you improve people's job prospects?
I would want to find out from you, Alex, outside the continent, what does Europe, what do other countries really gain from a stable Côte d'Ivoire?
Well, Europe's looking at Côte d'Ivoire as a stable, inverted commas, country in a rough neighborhood. And so they want a stable country with an enabling business environment. And Europe in particular is looking at how to invest more heavily in countries in West Africa because of shortened supply chains and because of geopolitics. So the tilt towards the west of the Ouattara administration is definitely welcomed, obviously in Paris, but also in Brussels. I think a challenge for Ouattara will be actually to diversify his relationships so he does not get pigeonholed, because it's clear that being seen as too Western and certainly too sympathetic to France is also not good electoral politics in Côte d'Ivoire, particularly not in the south in cities like Abidjan.
Right. Thank you very much. Dr. Alex Vines, Africa Director, European Council on Foreign Relations, much appreciated. Also, DW correspondent on the ground, Bram Postumus. Thank you very much.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Now, across Côte d'Ivoire, the scars of history are vivid. About 3,000 people died in the 2010 post-election violence. More than 80 lost their lives in 2020. In 2025, even though there were instances of conflict in some areas, most Ivorians say they want calm above everything else. Some young citizens share their thoughts with us.
Making way for younger people is bound to happen. But for me, as long as he's in good health, he can continue to work for us. So as long as he's in good health, he can continue to work. But there will come a time when Ouattara will inevitably make way for younger people. But that will come with time.
Alassane Ouattara is certainly elderly. But I think that after this new term of office, he can step down and make way for younger people. However, I don't think he is too tired due to his age to serve for the next 5 years.
What I expect from the new president in concrete terms is that he keeps to his word, keeps the peace, but also that he takes a good look at the education system and looks at ways to create work for the youth, because there are many young people who have no jobs.
What I would like the new president to do is to continue with the hard work his predecessor has put in, and that he creates employment for the young who have diplomas but are out on the streets doing nothing, just little odd jobs like working in mobile money shops or operate motor taxis, and an end to unemployment.
Over 70% of Ivorians are under 35. But one of the oldest leaders on the continent is staying put. The central challenge remains. Can Côte d'Ivoire navigate the balancing act between stability, democracy, and real inclusion? With economic promise but persistent inequality, many believe reforms and greater political openness are crucial. So can Ouattara use this new mandate to heal political rifts, share opportunities, and build trust?
Or does this mark a deeper slide toward democratic decline in a region already on edge? Share your thoughts with us on Facebook at DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.